Good morning. Our next case is 09-3282, Rural Water District No. 4 versus City of Eudora, Kansas. And our counsel, Mr. Tiedemann?
I pronounce it Tiedemann.
Tiedemann. Thank you for the pronunciation. As a Timkovich, I can appreciate mispronunciations.
You are not the first to pronounce it that way.
Thank you. You may proceed when you're ready.
My name is Kurt Tiedemann. I represent the City of Eudora, Kansas, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I could. Also with me here today is the City Administrator, Mr. John Herrenstein. You can stand up for a second there, John, just so that they know who you are. Thank you. In the remaining 12 minutes that I'd like to address with the court, I have two points that I really am going to hit on. I think they're the most important in the sense that they could dispose of the case, and I think they're also the most important from a public policy standpoint for this court, for cities, and for rural water districts. The first point is whether or not Douglas IV had the power under Kansas state law to even enter agreements with the federal government, which resulted in the federal guarantee and the 1926 protection, which plaintiffs argue follows from that. The second point is whether, as a matter of law, the city's conduct constituted curtailment or limitation, even if that protection existed.
Counsel, there's maybe a third question I'd appreciate you addressing at some point.
Okay.
Maybe first.
Help me.
And that is, what can we review here, given that you didn't file a 50B motion?
The 50B issue arose this way, Your Honor. And let me answer that succinctly and then take you through it. First of all, I don't think all of the issues that we've raised are sufficiency of the evidence questions. We have raised issues of law. We have raised evidence issues. We've raised instructional issues. Those also can fall into the category of sufficiency of evidence, but need not. There are other bases, for Your Honor, for the court to review these things. I will also argue with you that the failure to file a 50B motion in this particular case is no sort of impediment, and here's why I say that, Your Honor. If you look at the order of September 2nd, the one which the plaintiff claims is the judgment, I have to say in 25 years of practice, I've never seen anything purporting to be a judgment that looks quite like it.
Okay, counsel, here's where I think parties kind of go off the rails on that.
Okay.
It doesn't matter whether you got a judgment or not.
Whether what?
Whether you have a judgment or not. The deadline is just a deadline for filing a 50B. It doesn't preclude you from filing a 50B earlier. In fact, you can file a 50B the day after the verdict came down. That's the way it used to be. Right.
Well, I suppose you could file it before the verdict, for that matter, but
actually,
who would do that?
You can't. It's after the verdict. That would be 58 before the verdict.
Okay.
So 50B comes after the verdict.
Right.
And you have to file one before we can take up any sufficiency of the evidence. Yeah. I don't know, counsel. I don't know when the last day was.
Last day of what, Your Honor?
Last day you could have filed a 50B.
Okay.
That's what you guys debate about in your briefs.
Okay.
I don't know when that was. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Point is, you needed to file one at some point.
Well, Your Honor,
questions.
If that is your stance on this case, then I think the correct
thing. I think that's the law.
No, I understand. I understand your point, and I understand that's the law. But in this case, Your Honor, if there was not a judgment, then the time to have filed one has still not expired.
Then maybe we don't have jurisdiction over this appeal.
Okay, and that is the issue. But Your Honor can take jurisdiction, because I think that is where the law comes down, exactly what you just said. However, you can take
Do you want me to take jurisdiction if you haven't filed a 50B?
What I'd like you to do, Your Honor, is, and I think you can do it under 50B, because it is a claims processing rule, not a jurisdictional rule. I believe you can, and under the circumstances that I've described for you, I believe that you should review all the issues in this case. That's my feeling.
There may be jurisdiction because the 150 days has passed, the notice of appeal for purposes of FRAP 4. That's possible.
Right.
But, boy, you know, that puts you in a pincer position, because then we have jurisdiction over the case, and you didn't file a 50B, and we can't hear on appeal any issues that you didn't raise in your 50B count.
I think Your Honor can understand how we found ourselves in this position.
I actually can't.
Well, let me just tell you that. Because we have a September 2nd order, which says that is a memorandum in order, for an injunction, granting an injunction. There had been a jury verdict months prior, right? At the time that the order on the injunction comes down, There's nothing in the order that says anything about there being a judgment, other than in the body, a reference using a different name for the pleading. At the end of the order, where it says it is herefore a judge decreed, etc., says nothing about a monetary judgment. Talks only about the injunction. So there you are.
There you are. So you either file a 50B or you ask for clarification from the court for a judgment. That's what one does.
Well, it's easy to say that now. It's easy to say that now. You know, that's the issue, Your Honor.
So assume for a moment I can't hear anything in a 50B. What's left of this appeal?
Okay. If there's nothing left, you still have a question of whether or not, as a matter of law, what constitutes necessity under the state law in terms of whether or not that guarantee was a necessity. That's number one. What is necessity as a matter of law? What does it mean?
Counsel, in what posture does that arise? Is that a jury instruction that was challenged? Was that?
Yes.
Okay.
For one.
Okay.
There were evidence rulings that were overruled on that issue. Number two. All right. As I said, both of those issues, at a minimum, you have to review. Even if you think I should have filed a 50B motion. All right. The other question is, what constitutes a violation of 1926B? And that's probably, those are two of the cleanest legal issues that I think you need to address in this case.
Okay.
Now, I'll get back to those. I'll have to address them in a little bit of abbreviated fashion. But here's the question that I think you need to answer with respect to the first question, whether Douglas Four had the power under Kansas state law to enter into agreements with the federal government.
And what's the agreement that you're basing that argument on?
Okay, there's a loan commitment agreement. It's in the summary judgment documents, and it's marked for an appeal. But the document is a document signed by the city of Eudora, submitted to the federal government, where they are making application for this federal loan. If I have to pick it out of pleading right now, I'm not sure I could do it.
I mean, what I was looking for would be a contract between Douglas Four and the federal government.
That's what it is.
And, okay, that's a big document. Are you referring to the conditional commitment for guarantee?
I believe that's exactly the name of the document.
And that's the agreement that this case
Correct.
Turns on?
That's right. That's right. That guarantee cannot arise without the execution of that document.
Let's assume that I don't believe this is a contract between the water district and the federal government.
Then the other issue would be whether or not it constitutes cooperation with that federal agency under 82A619G. And I think it would fall under that category as well. But that's where you would have to get to the issue of authority.
Does it matter whether the water district cooperates or has an agreement with the federal government for the protections of 1926B to apply?
Does it matter whether they have an agreement?
Yeah, let me state it a different way. If First Bank had made the loan and then gone to the feds and gotten the loan guarantee, not necessarily with the cooperation or even the knowledge of the water district, would 1926B still apply?
I don't know how that could ever happen, Your Honor. I don't think it could happen that way.
Why not?
Let me just say that, and this may be what you're asking, but I'm not sure. Under Kansas law, rural water districts have absolutely no power other than that which is specifically given to them by statute. The only possible statutory authority,
the loan between Douglas Four and the bank, they could do that. There's no necessity clause for that, correct?
For the loan itself?
For the loan itself.
Oh, there's no question. There's no necessity. That's a different section. That's subsection H.
Right. But I guess
loans are specifically authorized. I agree.
I guess where I'm still bogged down is it seems to me the loan guarantee is between the bank and the federal government.
The guarantee itself is definitely between those parties.
And isn't that the agreement that we're concerned about?
No.
Under Kansas law?
No. KSA 82A-619G empowers the Rural Water District, quote, to cooperate and enter into agreements with the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture or the Secretary's duly authorized representative necessary to carry out the purposes of its organization. That is the only possible subsection.
It didn't enter into a loan guarantee agreement with the Department of Agriculture.
No,
the bank did.
Excuse me?
The bank did. Douglas Four is not a party to the loan guarantee, correct?
Not the guarantee itself, no.
Okay, so isn't that what this statute's referring to?
I don't believe so, no. The statute refers to cooperate or enter into agreements with. In other words, seek federal subsidy, whatever sort of federal help there is, that has to be necessary for the purposes of its organization. That's the argument. If you don't agree with it,
So any time the Department of Agriculture comes knocking on the Water District's door and, you know, asks it to do a survey or give it information, that invokes the necessity clause under Kansas law.
Again, that would be a different case. It's not the one we have here. I can't imagine how that case would ever get to the court.
Okay, well, I just wanted to understand your position. Your position is the Water District need not be a party to the loan guarantee. Completely irrelevant.
Right. The Water District is not a party to the loan guarantee. They're a party to the agreement that was necessary to produce that loan guarantee. I think that's what that refers to, and I don't think they had the power to do it. What
are you arguing that it falls under the or other aid that the Secretary of the United States?
Or other? I'm not following you there. Your language is or the duly authorized.
To accept financial aid.
Right. Right.
Or other aid. In other words, a loan guarantee to its lender? Is that what you're arguing?
No, I'm saying none of those. That second half of that paragraph doesn't apply. All of those sections are sections that don't apply to this case. If it's authorized, it's only possibly could be authorized under the first half of that provision. In other words, the cooperate or enter into an agreement with. And if I could, you know what? I'm going to use a little bit of my rebuttal time, if I may, to address the second point, which is the conduct which is supposedly alleged to have violated 1926B. I believe, and I had hoped to lay this out in a little bit more detail, but I believe what essentially happened in the district court and what the plaintiff is suggesting in this case is that even if you don't serve any water in that territory, and even if the water district has not lost one single customer, the mere assertion of rights or the mere denial of rights claimed by the plaintiff constitutes a violation of 1926B. And from a policy standpoint, that simply cannot be the case, Your Honor. Cities have the right, and in this case there were many litigatable questions that were rightfully brought up and should have been brought up. The plaintiff's position is that anything short of absolute and immediate capitulation constitutes a violation of 1926B. That's a very important policy issue, and it simply cannot be the law, and that is the effect of what the district court has done. I see I have approximately a minute and a half left, and if it's all right with you, I'll save that for a buck.
Certainly. Thank you, counsel.
All right.
Mr. Harris?
Steve Harris, Your Honor, for the appellee, cross-appellant, Rural Water District. Focusing on Mr. Tiedemann's power to enter into agreements, I think the court has captured the correct issue. The only document that's floating around that could possibly qualify is the conditional commitment that the USDA sent to the lender and sent to the Water District and said, hey, let's make sure that we're all square on this. We're going to give the guarantee, but here are the conditions, and we want to make sure you don't have any objections up front.
Why doesn't that qualify as cooperation under the statute?
I think it is cooperation. I think it definitely is cooperation. We have to cooperate. We asked the federal government for assistance. This didn't come out of the blue. It didn't come unannounced. So obviously we're cooperating. But there are four distinct reasons why the so-called necessary issue fails, and it is the centerpiece of this appeal. Certainly, 82A619G grants the water district the power to cooperate and the power to enter into agreements. Here we are certainly cooperating. However, the cases that we've cited to the court is that that issue is not reviewed at an objective level as to necessity. It does say that we can cooperate if it's necessary for the purposes of the district. But counsel for the appellants have focused on the word necessary and say we've got to have a jury trial every time some administrative agency, every time some public utility has an issue that they want to drop a line here, they want to gain an easement, they want to condemn some property, and this district has the authority to condemn property. Every time that decision is made, if we're saddled by the necessity determination, it could be challenged over and over again. We've cited the court a number of cases. There's the general communications case. This was a case before the Corporation Commission of Kansas. The dispute was is that the Corporation Commission says we're going to grant this license for a mobile phone tower. The competitors came in and said, well, that's not necessary. And the court responded and said, no, the review here is this is a decision made by a public agency. In that case, it was the Corporation Commission. They said we're only going to review those decisions, the necessary analysis, if fraud was involved, if bad faith was involved, or whether that agency abused its discretion. We don't have jury trials on the underlying issue. That is a discretionary decision for the administrative agency. We cited other cases.
Is the evidence challenge to the necessary determination?
I'm sorry.
Is there any? I'm trying to figure out what's left. Maybe you can help me of this case, given that there's no 50B motion. Is this argument wrapped up in a sufficiency challenge?
Well,
or do you think there's a legal challenge?
The legal challenge, I think, focuses toward Instruction 17. We objected to Instruction 17, and they objected to Instruction 17. Instruction 17 gave the jury some instruction and said, well, here's all this analysis. It's necessary if it satisfies a particular need, and went through a rather lengthy laundry list. Then at the tail end, in the last paragraph of this Instruction 17, the court makes the observation, by the way, it is not necessary for a water district to cooperate and enter into agreements if the sole purpose is to gain 1926B protection. We objected essentially on both sides of that, pointing the court back to that as a matter of law, the necessary analysis is not involved here unless the city raises the issue that the decision made by the district, unless, again, we're focused on necessary, if we cooperate, is there even a necessary analysis to be performed at all? If there is a necessary analysis, it's clearly a question of fact, and it's out. Hmm. So that would, at a threshold issue, there's got to be, whether you word it the way they would have liked or whether you word it the way we would have liked, it still involves a fact issue.
Okay, so besides the jury instruction, what else is left?
Side 17 and the... I'm looking for what is left in terms of those issues. From the appellant standpoint, I would say nothing. From the appellee cross-appellant's issue, I think there are several. First of all, we would contend as a matter of law, when the court looked at this, we contend that annexation alone in Kansas is, in fact, a 1926B violation. And I think if the court simply looks at 12-527 in Kansas, as opposed to a lot of other states that the Tenth Circuit has looked at regarding what's the impact of an annexation, Kansas is a bit unique. 12.527 says, upon an annexation by a city of any territory of a water district, two things can only happen. One is the city serves to the exclusion of the water district, or the water district has to obtain a license or permit. There's also, and of course both are forbidden by 1926B, but there's another important aspect that I think is perhaps easily overlooked, and that is paragraph C within 12.527. The city has made a lot about the fact that the city can agree to let the water district retain its infrastructure, not do any kind of forced buyout. Even if that occurs under 12.527C as a matter of law, the district loses its legal right to use those facilities to serve anywhere within the area that it's annexed. The statute expressly says if the district keeps its infrastructure, nothing is bought, and it moves on business as usual, it can only use that infrastructure inside the city to serve benefit units that are outside the city. That is an immediate and automatic taking.
But what if the city doesn't exercise those, you know, statutory rights, and the district continues to serve customers Where's the injury?
Well, the injury here, in theory,
there's, really no fact, there's no curtailment as a matter of fact. That serves the purposes of the statute, which is to, you know, make sure you don't lose your customer base.
I guess it, in a theoretical sense, if the city does absolutely nothing and annexes and literally nothing happens and we continue to serve, do we have a complaint? Probably not.
So that, I thought that's what Judge Robinson was saying. And
well,
that's why annexation alone, you know, without additional conduct, is not enough.
Judge Robinson originally ruled when she dismissed the original complaint filed by the Water District, she said you needed to allege that an annexation has occurred because annexation alone constitutes a 1926B violation. Now, her rulings have varied over time, and that position has changed, and she has said annexation alone is not enough. There needs to be more, like some kind of deprivation of service. Well, in this case, we provided those allegations and evidence at trial that there was an annexation and there were various threats and interferences.
Right, and the jury accepted that, right?
The jury settled that issue, absolutely.
Yeah, so, however, why do we even care about the annexation issue?
Even if
you're right, you prevailed on the actual curtailment. That's a fact question.
I care for it for this important reason. There's another issue that's on appeal before the court, and that's the church property. It relates to the legal right of the district to serve water outside its service boundaries. And, of course, we contend that we do have that legal right. District court disagreed. We also believe that the right to serve is also governed by 1926B, that the district has the right to provide service wherever it has or provided service. So if this court reverses on the church property and said, you know, Water District, you were right, you did have the legal right to serve under Kansas law, and therefore that impediment that the district found to deny any relief whatsoever, that impediment doesn't exist, and you can go ahead and proceed and take your action under the church property. If this case goes back to trial, we will be faced with the same issues relative to the various burdens that we've talked about. The necessary issue, I would like to see resolved, that no necessary analysis is even involved. The other issues we have looked at, such as the confiscatory cost, we're going to see every single defense that we saw the first time around appear the second time. The district court made us climb a steep mountain. We were successful nevertheless. But we will see those same impediments, those same obstacles that we have to overcome in the church property and perhaps other properties in the future between these same properties. And I don't want to have to continue to reclimb. In fact, the court could conclude that some of these issues are issue preclusive on us, that I'm bound by them because the circuit simply affirmed the decision and therefore must have stamped with its approval these various decisions made by the district court. And that's why I care, and that's why it's a concern. And it may even flow over into other cases. City of Lawrence is not far away. If we get involved in an issue with them, they'll come back and say, hey, look what happened in the Eudora case. You're stuck. You've got to climb all those steep mountains. For example, in the confiscatory analysis, it comes up in every 1926B case. However, here, the district court added a unique wrinkle, and that was, we've got to look at this fire protection issue. That's Instruction 20. And in Instruction 20, the court says right out of the box, the water district has no obligation to provide fire protection. But then continues relative to the confiscatory analysis and says, by the way, in looking at and determining whether the district's charges are unreasonable, you need to look at whether the district can provide fire protection or not. I view that as internally inconsistent within the instruction itself, that if we don't have an obligation, how can it suddenly come back through the back door where we look at it again based upon cost? Fortunately, in this case, despite that instruction, to provide fire protection to the principal customer involved, that was Garber, in order to provide fire protection to Garber, this particular water district was very lucky. And that is because they could provide fire protection, substantial fire protection, at a very tiny cost of about $10,000. In the normal situation that I see with respect to water districts, it's just not feasible at all at any price. It just can't be done because of the necessity of line sizes, volumes, et cetera. Those systems were just never designed for fire protection. And therefore, the courts have consistently said, you don't have the obligation. It's not a factor with respect to 1926B. But in this case, it finds itself back in. Granted, I won that issue. I prevailed. But I anticipate I will see that issue again if under the doctrine of issue preclusion. So that's an issue that kind of remains hanging around, which is what motivated the cross appeal. And addressing the church property specifically, and that I think that's a very important issue we have on appeal. 1926B in the Pitt 7 case, this court said that federal law, not state law, governs the scope of 1926B protection. There's a dissent in the Leax case out of the Sixth Circuit that set up barriers that are very different from the decisions from the Tenth Circuit. But the dissent in the Leax case said exactly the same thinking, is that federal law established the scope of 1926B protection, and if Congress wanted to narrow the scope of that protection to be limited to the state boundaries, the political boundaries of a rural water district, it would have said so. But it didn't. It said that those boundaries or that protection is those areas which the district has provided service or which it can provide service within a reasonable period of time. Now, when the district court looked at this issue regarding legal right, first the court acknowledges there is no statute in Kansas that forbids a water district from selling outside of its boundaries. In fact, the water district specifically held to itself in its own bylaws, and this is outlined in instruction number 17. Although 17 relates to the powers of the district, if you look at instruction 17, it enumerates one of those powers, and that is the power to sell water, provide service within our boundaries, and to others, whoever else we might want to provide water service to. 82A 621 of the Kansas statutes says if the district has surplus water, it can sell water to municipalities and other described entities. That, by definition, means the water district can sell outside of its boundaries because municipal boundaries in Kansas don't overlap water district boundaries. One serves to the exclusion of the other relative to water, and that's why we cited the court to the Mission Hills case. In Mission Hills, there was a battle between a water authority and a municipality, and the battle was ultimately resolved by the court saying, look, only one of two of these municipal corp-type entities can serve within a given area. So when the statute says we can serve or sell water to a municipality, by definition, Kansas says we can sell outside our boundaries. For the court to get at its conclusion, it first looked at 82A, Section 622. That's a procedure by which water districts attach additional area. And the reading of that statute is plain for what its purpose was. Water districts will expand their boundaries to have more participating members, and usually it's by a request. A landowner says, I want to be inside the district because, one, I want water service, and, two, I want to be able to participate in the affairs of the district. If you're outside the boundaries and you're a water customer and you're receiving service, and this district's been selling water outside its boundaries for years, but those folks would like to participate, they'd like to vote, they'd like to hold office, and therefore the whole process of annexing land, or the statute refers to as attachment of land, that is strictly for political purposes. The court then looked back at 82A619, the powers statute, which most of the cases have been involved with this necessary issue. The powers say that the district's power of condemnation is limited within its boundaries, but no such other boundary limitation is found within the statute. And therefore, if the Kansas legislature, just like the U.S. Congress, wanted to limit the power of the water district, it would have confined that power and said, we're going to limit your power to sell water within your boundaries. They did not do so, but they specifically did so with the powers of condemnation. I would submit that what the court has done, the district court, is looked into that statute and identified a limitation that simply is not there. I know I only have 15 seconds left. What I would urge the court to do is look back at a case that was cited by the Tenth Circuit in the Glenpool case. It's the Madison versus Bear Creek case. Within that case, cited by almost every other court that's ever looked at it, was a very brilliant analysis, and that was the court said, we're not going to tolerate any interference at any level in order to protect rural water districts and obey the dictates of 1926B. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kiedemann, you have a couple minutes.
All right. I'm going to pick up where counsel just left off, which is the Madison versus Bear Creek case, and I encourage you all to read that case very closely, too. I think what you will not find is any suggestion that merely asserting your rights and holding plaintiff's counsel to their burden of proof constitutes interference, and that's where we are today. That is what essentially was done when letters from counsel were admitted into evidence over my objection, and those letters were allowed to be characterized as a secret plan to break the law rather than what they were, which was simply communication regarding what the law required and whether or not plaintiff really had the rights they were claiming. With respect to the necessity issue, Your Honor, I think I heard Mr. Harris concede that at a minimum you must look at the instruction error on that. And so
that's what I heard, too.
That's the way I understood it. And so I think that's the bare minimum you have to do. I'm going to ask you, under the law we've cited, to review the other matters, and I believe that you can. Finally, with respect to the powers of the Water District to serve outside of their boundaries, I believe the district court was right. There would be absolutely no purpose for the Water District to expand their boundaries and give people the right to vote if they didn't need to expand their boundaries in order to serve those places. It makes absolutely no sense, and that is the logic that the district court used to arrive at that decision.
Thank you, counsel. Yeah. Counsel would be dismissed. The case is submitted. The court will take a short break.